Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 28th of May, these are our main stories. Ukraine says its military is ready to start its long-awaited counter-offensive against invading Russian troops. Turks go to the polls once again in the country's first-ever presidential runoff election. Iraq announces a $17 billion road and rail network project to link Europe and the Gulf. Also in this podcast, Japan unveils drastic proposals to tackle the problem of hay fever and...
Why has this show lasted?
Put your hands on your hips.
All the songs are great. It's witty. It's sexy.
As it turns 50, the enduring appeal of the Rocky Horror Show. Ukraine's most senior security official has revealed that the country is ready to launch its long-expected counteroffensive against Russian forces. In a rare interview, Alexei Danilov told the BBC that the planned assault was an historic opportunity, but the government had no right to make a mistake when making such an important decision. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale asked him when the offensive might begin.
We'll figure out when that will start so that we can have the best result at that point of war. It could happen tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, or in a week. It would be strange if I were to name dates or the start of that or another event. That cannot be done.
But you're ready.
We're always ready, the same as we were ready to defend our country at any time. And it is not a question of time. We have to understand that that historical opportunity that is given to us by God, to our country, we cannot lose, so we can truly become an independent big European country.
Do you feel under pressure from the West to deliver a quick victory?
Do you not know our president well?
Mr. Zelensky. I do not know him as well as you.
Do you think he can be pressured? I think there are no people like that except for his wife. We have a very responsible task before our country, and we understand that we have no right to make a mistake.
Can I ask you now about the situation in Bakhmut? How much of the city is now controlled by Ukrainian forces?
We control just a small part of the city, and we admit that. But you have to keep in mind that Bakhmut has played a big role in this war. It was a separate defense operation that played a big role today and in the future.
Are the Wagner mercenary group withdrawing, as their leader, Prigozhin, says?
Yes, that is happening. But it doesn't mean that they will stop fighting us. They're going to concentrate more on other fronts. Our intelligence is following that. We understand where they will appear next. They're regrouping to other three locations, and we're following that.
How concerned are you by the transfer of nuclear weapons from Russia to Belarus?
We are absolutely calm about it. To us, it's not some kind of news. Belarus has been occupied by the Russian Federation since the time when Lukashenko had his unsuccessful election.
The words of Alexei Danilov. He was speaking there to James Landale. Since that interview, Russia's ambassador to the UK has warned that arms supplied from the West to Ukraine risk escalating the war to levels not seen so far. In an interview with the BBC, Andrei Kellin accused NATO countries, in particular Britain, of causing an escalation which might take on dimensions that, in his words, Moscow did not need or want. He also warned of a new dimension in the conflict.
It's a big idealistic mistake to think that Ukraine may prevail. Russia is 16 times bigger than Ukraine. We have enormous resources, and we haven't just started yet to act very seriously.
Andrei Kellin. The presidential election runoff is taking place in Turkey on Sunday. In the first round, there weren't enough votes to separate President Erdogan and his challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. The election takes place against a backdrop of a troubled economy with inflation in double figures and the Turkish lira losing value. Anna Foster spoke to me from Istanbul.
This has been a long campaign that came to a head 2 weeks ago with that first presidential and parliamentary election. And now what we're seeing is this runoff. So things like the economy, the country's handling of those devastating earthquakes in the south of Turkey back in February have been on the agenda. Also things like immigration as well, and the fact that Turkey hosts around 3 million or so Syrian refugees. That's been a really big topic.
You've been speaking to people in Istanbul. What are they saying?
It's really the key issues, things that you might expect. It's things like how they're coping in the economic crisis. The immigration debate, that really has sparked a lot of interest and a lot of discussion. This is what they had to say.
On the migration issue, it's important to produce permanent policies. I think it's not feasible to find a solution that says they should stay or go. These policies should not be solely made by Turkey.
I believe they've been receiving too much tolerance. Our own population needs jobs just as much. I think migrants have been given too much. They've even been granted nationality as well, and I find it very upsetting.
One man, President Erdogan, delivered more than he promised for 21 years. The opposition is promising things that reduce the opportunities for young people. If the opposition comes into power, the country will be divided in two. Erdogan is the most logical candidate, but I don't want to support Erdogan. But there isn't really another option for me.
And what else is on the agenda? Issues like the cost of living?
Very much so. I mean, that has been a big problem here in Turkey for a long time. The value of the lira has plummeted, inflation has soared. People have really felt it in their pockets and they want somebody to try and make a change.
So, Anna, why is this election in Turkey important for the rest of the world and, of course, for Europe?
It matters hugely, and that's because Turkey, it has an interesting geographical position, of course. I mean, I'm standing here talking to you on the edge of the Bosphorus, where we've got, of course, the European side of Istanbul, the Asian side. It's a physical representation of how this country looks both east and west. You look at the relationships that Turkey has had with Russia, for example, negotiating the grain deal between Russia and Ukraine to keep the grain flowing after the invasion just over a year ago. Turkey occupies an important position. It's set itself up as a broker in different world events. It looks both east and west. And what happens here will have an impact globally.
Anna Foster speaking to me from Istanbul. South Africa's governing party, the ANC, which has been in power since the end of apartheid, has acknowledged that it may lose its majority if it can't fix the country's energy crisis. The Secretary General of the ANC has told the BBC that prolonged rolling power cuts are the party's Achilles heel. And the leader of a radical opposition party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, says collapse of the national grid this winter could spark a revolution. Stephen Sacker reports from Cape Town.
It's just after noon in Khayelitsha Hospital, in the middle of Cape Town's biggest township, home to more than a million people. The power's just gone off. The lights are out. But in a shed outside, emergency generators soon kick in. Coping with what they call load shedding is now the difference between life and death. David Binzer is CEO of Khayelitsha Hospital.
With load shedding now, we have to switch off our machine. Our generator, before it takes off, is about 2 to 3 minutes. Then it means this is going to be down for that much.
So for 2 or 3 minutes, a patient who is on this respirator, being kept alive, the machine is going to go down?
Yes. And if we do not have an inverter like we have now, then it means we'll have to disconnect and manually delay that patient.
Literally, manually pump the oxygen.
Yes, for the patient to be alive.
South Africa's power crisis isn't just an urban problem. Drive 3 hours out of Cape Town and you reach one of the finest citrus-growing regions in the world. Here, Robert Patterson grows the clementines that you see in your local supermarket, but only if there's power to pump precious groundwater to his state-of-the-art irrigation system.
We're pumping from down at the bottom of the hill, and then the water is pushed up here to whichever orchard needs to be running at the moment.
Your entire operation is absolutely dependent on your irrigation system.
Absolutely dependent. And at the moment, we're looking at 11 and a half hours out per day. This is why we've had to invest in diesel power generators to run these systems.
South Africa simply can't afford this power crisis. 50% of young adults are jobless, and this after 29 years of uninterrupted ANC rule. The party's Secretary General is Fikile Mbalula.
This load shedding has just made a mess of our country. It is an Achilles heel for our government. South Africa is undergoing challenges, but to put us into a category of a failed state, it's an exaggeration. If certain things are not resolved, we will become a failed state.
Back in Khayelitsha, Wiseman Bambata's one-room upholstery business is failing to meet orders because his electric sewing machine is too often idle. In the past, many South Africans were willing to give the ruling ANC the benefit of the doubt. Maybe not now.
I would like to see a different government because I'm losing hope from our government.
These are the people who say, we gave you liberation.
I think they must deliver what they promised because they're going to lose people. They are failing us a lot.
South Africa's ANC government isn't meeting basic public needs on housing, sanitation, jobs and security. The party's loudest, most radical opponent is Julius Malema, leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters. According to the polls, the ANC may well need his support to form a coalition after next year's election. But he says change may come by way of an uprising rather than the ballot box.
There's going to be a revolution. I'm not wishing it. I'm saying it's going to happen. People are going to rise. There will be leaderless. There will be anarchy. There will be looting all over this country because nothing will be working.
Julius Malema speaking to Stephen Sacker. And you can hear Stephen Sacker's series of interviews with South Africa's key political leaders on the World Service's Hard Talk, available on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. Since President al-Sisi came to power in 2014, it's thought 7,000 kilometres of roads and 900 bridges and tunnels have been built across Egypt, mainly by the military. The authorities insist no damage has been done to ancient graveyards or registered monuments, some dating back to the Arab conquests in the 7th century. The BBC's Wael Hussein in Cairo has been documenting the story about what's happening in the capital for the BBC. And he spoke to Paul Henley.
The authorities here consider anything that is not 100 years old is not a monument. And that's a problem because not everything that is older than 100 years is registered. And even these places who are not 100 years old have some historical significance. So they are doing terrible damage to these places. I have been to two of the cemeteries where they are now demolishing graves. There are about 2,600 graves that have been marked for demolition. These places, they are close to Muslim saints. People have spent a lot of money to be buried there. Places where royals, sultans, kings and queens and celebrities, they are buried there and they have unique architecture. They just demolish. There haven't been any committees discussing what to be demolished and what is not. So the bulldozer is in action there without distinguishing between what is old and what is new, what is historical and what is not. And that's the problem. Things that have unique design and architecture, marble formations, burial places of dignitaries being grazed.
There are volunteers, aren't there, trying to stop this happening?
There are many volunteers. People who are interested in art and in architecture, the geographical integrity of this city. This city was founded in the 10th century, the City of the Dead, which I wrote about in my piece. This is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Many of the volunteers are trying to save what can be saved.
And what kind of thing are they salvaging?
Headstones, marble formations, because the tomb usually, if for a celebrity or someone from the royal family, it's marble formation. Arabic calligraphy, very distinguished art stuff. So they are trying to salvage these slabs of stones that are hundreds of years old, trying to salvage the names. For example, I've seen the graveyard, like an Egyptian commander who fought in Crimea in the 19th century. People who are not very familiar to the Egyptian public. It's a sprawling city. The authorities say it's a city of 20 million people. But many of the people here don't buy the government excuse for demolishing this cemeteries. Some believe that, yes, it will make the traffic flows, it will help transportation, but just they are destroying your heritage.
Will Hussein in Cairo, and you can see photos of the City of the Dead on the BBC News website. Iraq has unveiled an ambitious plan to develop its rail and road infrastructure and become a regional transport hub linking Europe and the Gulf. With more details, here's Youssef Taha.
The project, dubbed Route of Development, will see high-speed freight and passenger trains traveling at up to 300 kilometers an hour, more than six times the speed of current rail services. The Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammad Shia al-Sudani, announced the $17 billion project at a meeting in Baghdad with transport officials from neighboring countries. He described the 1,200-kilometer project, which will stretch from the border with Turkey in the north to the Gulf in the south, as the cornerstone of a sustainable non-oil economy that would contribute to regional integration. The project is one of the steps Baghdad is making to attract foreign investments and regain a foothold in the region after decades of wars, sanctions, and corruption. The project is forecast to be completed within 3 to 5 years.
Youssef Taha. Still to come here on the Global News Podcast, 70 years after conquering Everest, what would Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary think of how it's done nowadays?
If my father had known what was going to happen today, I don't think he or Hillary would have been very pleased to see the number of people climbing today and the way it is being climbed today.
Welcome back. Google has removed a highly controversial game called Slavery Simulator from its App Store after it caused outrage in Brazil. The game, which allowed players to buy and sell black characters, was downloaded more than 1,000 times before it was removed. The game makers, Magnus Games, have insisted they condemn slavery. David Lewis has been following the story.
Slavery Simulator is no ordinary game. Not only could players trade in slaves, gamers were also allowed to inflict various forms of torture on black characters. Those who downloaded the app were perhaps alerted to the subject matter in the game's cover picture. A white man in a three-piece suit and sun hat with cane in hand, surrounded by shirtless black men. Players could decide: liberate enslaved characters, or game makers promise they could use slaves for your own enrichment, prevent the abolition of slavery, and accumulate wealth. And, understandably, the game has been sharply criticised by some Brazilians. Blatant racism, tweeted Renata Souza, a regional politician in Rio de Janeiro. It's absurdly violent. Google and the developer must answer for this crime of hatred and racism, the black activist added. In its description, Magnus Games said the app was created for what it describes as solely entertainment purposes. The Office of Brazil's Public Prosecutor has said it had now opened an investigation into how the game was allowed onto the Google Play Store in the first place. The legacy of slavery in Brazil is an incredibly sensitive and emotive subject. More than 4 million enslaved people were taken to the South American country in the early 19th century. As many as 1.5 million of the 3.5 million people living in the country were slaves. The former Portuguese colony only abolished the practice in 1888.
David Lewis. It's estimated that pollen allergy affects 20% of the world's population. That's more than 1.5 billion people. The condition can seriously affect a sufferer's quality of life, especially in spring and summer. And Japan says it's costing the country billions of dollars because of its effect on the economy. So they've announced drastic plans to rectify the problem. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Will Leonardo, explains.
This is a draft proposal seen by Japanese media. After a few months of hay fever being a hot topic in Japan, the measures include increasing quotas on cutting down mature Japanese cedar trees, which are ubiquitous around the country, so that in 10 years their numbers are reduced by 20%. And the government intends to encourage home builders to use more cedar wood as construction material, and then it's going to replace those cedar trees with cedar tree saplings, which don't produce pollen, and also other types of low pollen trees. And the aim is to reduce pollen levels by half within 3 decades.
So they see this as a big problem. How is it affecting the health and indeed the wealth of the Japanese?
In the 1960s, when figures were first taken for Japanese hay fever sufferers, it was a relatively uncommon ailment. Now some 40% of Japanese are said to be sneezing their way through spring. This year, a warm spring has led to pollen levels reaching a 10-year high, and that's been borne out anecdotally with many people, including some politicians, complaining that their hay fever is much worse. It's even been described in Parliament as the national disease. That's led to sales of medicines, including eye drops and antihistamines, nasal sprays, all the things that we all use, to soar. And many Japanese appear to be retaining their COVID-era masks in a bid to alleviate their symptoms. And as you say, it's leading to more sickness and worse productivity. Estimates from previous years say Japan's economy loses almost $2 billion a year, and that's without this year's high pollen levels.
Now, people suffer from hay fever across the world, more than a billion, perhaps as many as 1.6 billion. Why is it a particularly big problem in Japan?
It's the Japanese cedar trees that are the big problem there, although other species also contribute. After the Second World War, vast swathes of the country were planted with these cedar trees for their timber. But as the economy grew and the price of wood fell, many plantations were left underused and have spent decades growing into mature pollen-producing woods. And of course, rising temperatures aren't helping. We talked about a very warm spring this year. This isn't the first attempt to tackle this issue, but it seems to be among the most concerted. It's worth mentioning that this round has its genesis in Parliament, when last month an MP urged the Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, to take action, saying his name would go down in history if he eradicated the problem. Mr. Kishida then unexpectedly promised action at a cabinet level, and some reports say that blindsided civil servants, who then had to rush to convene meetings and put together proposals. And in many ways, politically, it seems an easy win for him to promise action on this allergy that blights so many Japanese. Analysts have said that he may soon call a snap election.
Will Leonardo. France and the Netherlands have signed a treaty formalising their border on the Caribbean island of St. Martin, 375 years after it was first demarcated. The two halves remain dependencies, but there have been arguments about the exact course of the frontier. Here's Charles Haviland.
Legend has it that in the early 17th century, two groups of runners, one from each colonial power, set out from Oyster Bay on the east coast of the 90 square kilometre island, one going north and the other south. From where they eventually met up on the west coast, a line was drawn to the starting point, marking what is still today's border between the larger French portion of St. Martin and the smaller Dutch one. But till now there have been border disputes, especially over who controls the waters of Oyster Bay. This new accord demarcating the frontier is supposed to aid rebuilding work following Hurricane Irma, which hit 6 years ago, and encourage cross-border cooperation with a joint monitoring commission. Despite the squabbles, the divided St. Martin is dubbed the Friendly Island, thanks to the generally peaceful coexistence, and because of the unusual athletic feat that is said to have divided it up in the 17th century.
Charles Haviland. It is 70 years since Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary reached the summit of Mount Everest. Today, hundreds of people attempt the same feat every year, and thousands more trek to base camp. In 1953, this was how Pathé News reported their return from the summit.
From Kathmandu, capital of Nepal, come first pictures of the city's preparations to welcome back the conquerors of Mount Everest. Crowds throng the streets of the capital to celebrate the conquest of the mountain, which at last has yielded the secrets it has held since the beginning of time. In procession, troops march through the city to honor Tenzing, to whom the King of Nepal has given the title Tiger of Tigers.
Well, Tenzing Norgay's son, Jamling, is also a mountaineer. He's at base camp to mark the anniversary and sent us his thoughts on what the two men achieved back in 1953.
70 years ago is a long time. Reflecting back on what these two gentlemen did, you know, Hillary and my father, one of the greatest achievements of all time. They showed us that anything is possible if you work together as a team, you are passionate about something, and you have the right drive, and you can achieve your goals. Anything is possible. We are all thrilled that the Hillary family and our family, that 70 years we are celebrating everywhere around the world, including, you know, the Everest region. where the Sherpa land, the home of the Sherpas, the climbing industry has become very commercialized. It's all about who has satellite setups, or, you know, who has a computer, who has a heater, who has a nice double bed at base camp. This is not called adventure. You know, when you go to climb a mountain, you're actually going there to seek an adventure. I don't think I would call this an adventure, you know, or a challenge. And the Sherpas have to carry these big oversized loads through the icefall. But my main concern is that the safety standards should be higher. This year alone, 12 people have died. And I think maybe about 100 plus people have had frostbites. 70 years ago, if my father had known what was going to happen today, I don't think he or Hillary would have been very pleased to see the number of people climbing today and the way it is being climbed today. They were basically pioneers. They were exploring new territories, new mountains. They basically paved the way for the rest of the world.
Jamling Tenzing on his father, Tenzing Norgay, and Edmund Hillary's conquest of Everest 70 years ago. And finally, it's time to look out your fishnets. Get ready for a jump to the left and a step to the right, because the Rocky Horror Show is about to turn 50. It was June 1973 when it debuted in a tiny attic theatre here in London. That initial run attracted visits from the likes of Mick Jagger, David Bowie and Rudolf Nureyev. Since then, its cult status has continued to grow, as our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports.
Don't get strung out by the way I look.
The Rocky Horror Show.
Don't judge a book by its cover.
50 years of transvestites, transsexuals and time warps. And this is where it all began.
What a dump.
The 63-seater theatre upstairs at London's Royal Court.
It still is a black attic room with not much going for it.
Yeah.
Original cast members Nell Campbell, who played the groupie Columbia, and Rainer Borton, who was Rocky, the mad scientist Frankenfurter's creation. They'd not been back since their original five-week run in 1973.
Why has this show lasted?
Put your hands on your hips.
All the songs are great. It's witty. It's sexy. It includes bisexual, transsexual, cross-dressing, homosexual.
People actually felt liberated. They realised that other people felt the way they felt and expressed it.
Yeah.
And that gave them the licence to go out and express it and be themselves. Don't dream it.
And remember, it was 1973 and homosexuality had only been legalised 5 years before.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll.
The Rocky Horror Show was written by Richard O'Brien. He was also the original riffraff, both on stage and in the film. He's 81 and, speaking from New Zealand, expressed his delight at the Rocky Horror turning 50.
The longevity of Rocky has always been a mystery, because it really is a childish piece of juvenilia. Joyously, that's so, don't get me wrong. Probably that has got a lot to do with, actually, that it is unpretentious and a little bit of nonsense.
The Rocky Horror may have been groundbreaking with its celebration of gender and sexuality. However, the show's creator believes the current climate makes it very hard to contribute to debates surrounding trans issues.
No matter what you say, you're going to upset somebody.
It's interesting. Any celebrity I ask about these issues is now terrified to talk about it because they've seen what happened to J.K. Rowling.
I don't quite understand what she said that's supposed to be so upsetting. If someone has a sex change, that's a fact. The reality is, just be happy. You know, feel liberated by the journey and have joy in your life.
Don't dream it. Be it.
And for these Rocky Horror fans, it's clear just how much joy the show still brings.
The beauty, the edginess, the gender blending of it is just completely speaking to my soul.
It's essentially the transgressive nature of it all, but also it's a lot of fun.
I saw this 40 years ago. I'm 74 in June. I told him he's got to wear drag, but he wouldn't.
The Rocky Horror. 50 years have passed in the blink of a time warp.
Colin Paterson on The Rocky Horror Show. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Danny Cox and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.